This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zandin for Jane Lindholm. Few of us are homesteaders, but many of us understand and share the impulse to simplify life and become more self-reliant. In Vermont, the movement known as Back to the Land was so strong it helped define a period in the state's history in the 1960s and 70s. That's when, during the height of the Vietnam War and a period of social turmoil, many young people came here to pursue a life on the land communally and individually. Many had read a book written years earlier about homesteading in Vermont, Living the Good Life by Helen and Scott Nearing. It languished in obscurity before it was embraced by the young members of the counterculture, a fact that Nearing's historian Greg Jolly says is not without irony.
Scott couldn't stomach long hairs. He could not stand the drug culture at all. I mean, this is a man who was a raw fooder who felt that tea and coffee were stimulants that were bad for the system. And so there was a real friction there. And yet at the same time, it was this culture that was looking for an alternative way out of what they felt was this confining, militarized society, and they turned to the Nearings. If it wasn't for the Back to the Land movement, he would be a footnote of a footnote of a footnote.
Today on Vermont Edition, we'll look at how the idea of homesteading has been defined and pursued over time, over generations. What defines it even as it has changed, and what the majority of us who will never live a homesteading life might draw from it. Not everyone is enamored of the idea of homesteading. To some, it may seem like a selfish thing, shirking responsibility to community, economy, and culture. To others, it's the only sane response to a world where the environment is threatened and the culture places a premium on consumerism. What about you? What do you make of the desire by some to live as independently as possible? How do you define homesteading? And are there aspects of the Back to the Land ethic that you try to incorporate in your own life? We'd like to hear from you today. Our number, 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or post your comments or questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're joined today by Rebecca Neal Gould, who's a writer and senior lecturer in the Environmental Studies program at Middlebury College. Her book, At Home in Nature, Modern Homesteading and Spiritual Practice in America, was published in 2005. She's also on the board of a couple of national movements, Take Back Your Time and the Simplicity Forum. Rebecca, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. It's great to be back, Steve.
We use the term back to the land, homesteading, interchangeably. I'm not sure how accurate we are in doing so, and I'm not sure whether there's another name for this that you think is more apt, descriptive, and appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, as a scholar, I always try to first focus on what are people calling themselves? Who do they see themselves as? And in terms of the book, most people call themselves homesteaders. That's what Helen and Scott called themselves. That often gets confused with the original Homestead Act, which is about grabbing up a lot of land, so a very different idea. Back to the land movement, though, is a term that I think most Vermonters would recognize because of Vermont's own history. When I wrote the book, the first rounds of the book, I didn't even know I was going to end up living in Vermont, where everybody has something to say about the Nearings and something to say about back to the land. So I think for shorthand, it's a great term. Many of the people that I wrote about and the people I'm still interested in today wouldn't say they were part of a movement or only sort of saw that in retrospect because they were mostly trying to solve problems of meaning for themselves. So that's why I chose the word homesteader. But I think one doesn't have to argue about terms. It's more interesting to see sort of how people define themselves. And I think also that there's a long range, you hinted at that just now, of activities that aren't homesteading per se but sort of participate mm-hmm. in that ethos.
All right. Well, let's use homesteader. How would you define a homesteader?
Well, in my book, which I actually haven't consulted yesterday, but I believe that one of the things that I centered on was food production and sustainability and growing at least 50% of your own food. That was certainly the case for almost everyone I interviewed near the Nearings. But I think also it has to do with an attitude of mind and personal history. So, you know, for many people that I talked with, I used the language in my analysis of conversion experience. Many people had read Walden or the Nearings or both and said, I have to change my life and go back to the land, whether they used that particular phrase or not. And so part of how I defined homesteading was, did they go through this kind of process where they had been living in suburbs or cities or in some way trying to figure out their lives and decided this is the action I need to take? So I'm talking about inner experience as much as I'm talking about self-sufficiency.
Well, is that then what might distinguish homesteading from what so many generations of Vermont farmers did since the 1700s,
yes,
essentially.
Yes, that's an excellent point, because you could see in Maine, where I did most of my research, in Vermont too, especially in the 60s and 70s, people side by side doing what look like the same kind of practices, but the meaning that they ascribe to those practices are different. And in fact, in Walden, Thoreau criticizes farmers all the time because he sees them as part of the market economy that he's trying to critique.
Right.
In the 60s and 70s in Vermont and Maine, farmers aren't so much the object of people's ire, but corporations and the consumer culture, that's where they're directing their energy. But the critique is actually very similar.
We talk about the 60s and 70s and that what people call a movement, back to the land movement of people coming to Vermont to try to live off the land. Were there other periods when something akin to a movement of this sort was taking place?
Yes and no, in the sense that there are some individuals I wrote about in the book and that I'm interested in because of their writing and who they are, who were really acting as individuals. John Burroughs would be a good example. Ralph Borsodi started out solving individual problems in the 1920s, 1930s, and then that did spawn a kind of a movement where he set up the School of Living that then became its own thing, something that everybody would have ever heard of, but certainly one of those critiques of the dominant culture. So
where and what was the School of Living?
Well, the School of Living, he started in Suffern, New York, and worked with Mildred Loomis. And Borsodi is this interesting person because the Nearings were aware of him but didn't talk about him that much. They liked to promote what they were doing, and Borsodi was also doing his own self-sufficiency thing. But he wasn't a vegetarian, he wasn't a pacifist. He had a swimming pool that he made at his house. So he was talking about trying to solve the problem of distribution, but he wasn't living in that kind of austere way that the clip from my friend Greg Jolly just talked about. That wasn't of interest, but to him, he was still critiquing consumer culture and critiquing the ways of living that are dominant in our culture. And so the School of Living became, it still exists now, I think you could probably find it on the web, a sort of popular movement that Mildred Loomis, Borsodi's friend, then promoted further that kept this critique going.
And of course, if I recall, I mean, the Nearings didn't occur in a vacuum. Scott Nearing had lived in a community, I want to say in New Jersey or somewhere.
Yeah, Delaware actually was a community, a single tax community known as Arden. And it's a great part of Scott Nearing's story that a lot of people don't know because it's not that well popularized. Greg has talked about it. I talked about it in my book. And that's where he first was trying out different models of living. That's where he built his first stone house, first did his gardening in an organic way before organic was a common term.
How much is homesteading, the back to the land ethos, about a rejection of things versus embracing other things?
You know, that's a great question. And I'm interested in that dynamic because I'm, fundamentally, I've gone a lot of different directions, but I started out as a scholar of comparative religion, so I was very interested in spirituality, how people spiritualize nature, and therefore looking at sort of meaning-making and what meaning-making is all about. It really is, what do you reject? What do you embrace? How do you realign your life around certain values? And so I think for Scott and Helen, they really enjoyed rejecting. They enjoyed saying, we're not about this, we're not about that. And a lot of people criticize them for the sort of strength of their ideas and their inability to budge on them. But you could also say that they're embracing some very important things in their work. Pacifism was very important to Scott. Vegetarianism was important to both of them. So when I interviewed the various people who were inspired by the Nearings or inspired by Thoreau, that language of rejection and embracing, both of those came in. I think I paid more attention to the embracing part because I find that more inspiring.
Mm-hmm. You bring up Scott Nearing's pacifism and vegetarianism, which he wrote about in Living the Good Life, which again was about his homesteading experience in Vermont. And he wrote, quote, "The society from which we moved had rejected in practice and in principle our pacifism, our vegetarianism, and our collectivism." So are those values that are shared by all homesteaders?
Not at all. Not at all. And I think the more recent homesteaders, I think there's, for instance, big arguments that I almost hesitate to bring up about meat eating, vegetarianism, local food, killing your own animals, things like that, where, in fact, the Nearings would be quite shocked at the kind of language of locavore when it involves meat. They would come out strongly against that.
So they would say you're not a homesteader if you're raising your own meat?
Well, they might say you're trying to be a homesteader, but your values are completely inaccurate and not about peace and health and so on and so forth. So they would go right after that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, and pacifism is a stance that only a few people take very seriously. So again, I think you'd see a lot of homesteaders who would say, well, maybe yes, maybe no. So it gets at the life stories, what really motivated people. I would say that what I see is a common rejection running through from Thoreau through the Nearings all the way to the present is sort of what's wrong with America? What values do the dominant culture have that we want to raise questions about, both in terms of rejection and embracing? And I see those primarily now being environmental concerns, concerns about climate change, concerns about corporate culture, consumer culture. And the Nearings never called themselves environmentalist until they were claimed as such by the people who followed them. But concern about the dominant culture and the culture of consumption as it was emerging, that runs right from Walden all the way to the present.
Well, you know, you mentioned Thoreau, and you mentioned earlier his criticism of farmers, and I'm trying to remember my Walden, but it strikes me that, you know, he was not a guy who was, you know, out there growing his own food and being self-sufficient in that way, yet you cite him as sort of a lodestar of the back-to-the-land movement. Is there a tension there?
There is certainly a tension there, and I think as a scholar, one of my interests is trying to recover Thoreau from all the ways in which he's misunderstood. I wouldn't call him a homesteader at all. He did a two-year experiment that was very much an experiment, not so much about self-sufficiency, but about how to become a writer, how to grieve the death of his brother John, which is seldom talked about, creating space for himself, figuring out his identity, working on a week on a Concord Merrimack Rivers, becoming more of a naturalist. His agenda was not self-sufficiency, but per se. And he never said he was trying to do that. But what he was trying to do was free up as much time as possible to pursue the inner life. And the way that he did that is to say, if my needs are very few, if I lead a simple life, if I grow my own beans, if I don't rely too much on other people, then I can have the kind of life I want. So in that way, he's connected to a lot of other homesteaders in terms of the big questions, which I'm always interested in, which is value, purpose, meaning.
Right. You know, and I think a lot of people, when they hear about homesteading and what it entails, and you hear about the Nearings were very regimented. Every day was broken up into, what, four-hour segments, was it? And each segment devoted to a certain activity. And it sounds kind of cheerless, joyless.
Well, there's so many misrepresentations of the Nearings, and I also have my own critiques of them while I admire them greatly. They had this 4-4 model, which was also about freeing up space and time. Unfortunately for them, as they became more and more popular and people were flocking first to the Vermont home and then to Maine, and this was my own experience when I lived in Helen's house after she died, is, you know, having the time actually to do these pursuits didn't happen. So they had the value, and I think that model worked early on in their lives. And then they made big decisions to try and protect their time, sometimes not so successfully, other times more so. So, you know, they had their regime, and then they had the challenges to it. Joyless, cheerless, that certainly was never my experience of Helen. Scott died before I started this project.
And we should mention, you spent time with Helen when she was in Maine. Near the end of her life?
Yeah, and of course her life was a complete, her death was a complete surprise. She died in a car accident, ran into a tree. Before then, I was, in the years before that happened, I was up in Maine. I was living in Cambridge, but I was up in Maine interviewing Helen and interviewing various people who were also inspired by her. I was very interested in the people around her as much as I was interested in her. She was funny. She was sort of a kind of a sprite. She had a great energy and joy to her. So I think to say that they were cheerless would be inaccurate. And Scott, too, if you see him on film, is chuckling at himself and society. But was he stern? He was also very stern.
Let me ask you before we go to a break and bring listeners into the conversation. You've used the word spirituality a number of times in the conversation as, describing how in some ways it might have differentiate homesteaders from farmers who worked on the land in Vermont and New England for many, many years. Be a little more specific about that spirituality.
Sure. And first, I would say I can't speak for the farmers who've been here for many generations. I'm sure they would say that there's something deeptly meaningful about their work.
I suspect you're talking about something other than religiosity.
Right, exactly. And it's a continuum. So it was kind of radical for me as a scholar of religion to say we need to take these practices seriously, but that's exactly what my book was about. So for many people who, and again, their initial reasons may not have been spiritual, but almost everyone I interviewed and many people I've talked with since have said, in living close to nature, I've found nature to be sort of a source of meaning and authority bigger than anything else. So would I call it religion with an R, capital R, in terms of comparing it to Christianity, Judaism, Islam? No. Would I say it's part of American religious history? Yes, because going back to nature and feeling a spiritual connection to nature has this history from Walden to the present. And I hesitate to define spirituality. That would be a whole Vermont edition in itself. But this idea of meaning and authority, this is where I have my deepest spiritual experiences, is in the natural world. What would it mean to live by nature's rules, to live according to the seasons, to live ecologically? That feeds my soul. It was that kind of language that mm-hmm. I was hearing.
All right. Today on Vermont Edition, we're discussing the history and meaning of homesteading with Rebecca Neal Gould. What's motivated people to strive for simplicity and self-sufficiency? How has the definition of homesteading changed over generations? And we're asking you what you think of the homesteading ideal and whether you have questions about the history of homesteading. Call us at 1-800-639-2211 or you can post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zind in for Jane Lindholm. And today we're talking about homesteading in Vermont, the idea of living as lightly and simply as reasonably possible, the ethic and beliefs that involves, and who's doing it today. Though most of us don't homestead, many of us feel something of the same impulse, perhaps reflected in our gardening or keeping a few laying hens, or an appreciation and reverence for the natural world. Are there practices you follow that reflect the homesteading ethic? Are there those you reject? 1-800-639-2211 is our number. My guest is Rebecca Neal Gould, who's an author and senior lecturer at the Environmental Studies Program at Middlebury College. So let's talk to Tom in Richmond. Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for the program. A couple of comments. One is my understanding about the Nearings is that self-sufficiency wasn't exactly what they were doing. They were both trust funders, or at least one of them was. That's what I've heard. But they represented something, and that's the more important part. Just like Emerson was a foil for Thoreau, the Nearings were a foil for what actually is our state motto, which is freedom and unity. All this is covered really well in a movie by Nora Jacobson called The Vermont Movie. It's in 6 feature-length installments, and it really does a good job of kind of showing the character, not only of the people who lived here, but people who walked here, and why they were able to get along and find some common ground on our soil. That's my comment, and take it where you want. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom. Tom brings up a point that's sometimes a rap against the Nearings, that they had resources that some others didn't have, and therefore they had kind of a leg up in the homesteading effort.
Yes, and I completely agree with the critique, and I want to plug at least 2 books here in that connection. One is a book by Jean Hay Bright called Meanwhile, Next Door to the Good Life, and the other is a book by Donna Brown called Back to the Land, both great books in different ways. And they both raise these issues about sort of they're the Nearings and then they're everybody else. And I think the Nearings did set up unintentionally, I think, a sort of a wave of disappointment by those real life people who are trying to do what they did. And they didn't feel like they got the whole truth from the Nearings. I don't love the term trust fund, but it is true that the research brings out that, in fact, Helen was able to do a lot of the land purchasing because she had a gift of money from a Dutch friend. Scott had his own investments, which are quite ironic given sort of his stances. So there were inconsistencies for sure. And I think the biggest problem with that is that, in fact, that led to people making real difficult life choices and then saying, wow, this is a lot harder than the Nearing said.
Yeah, and it brings up the question, I mean, is homesteading kind of a middle-class luxury in a way? The Nearings paid a few dollars an acre, I think, for the land they bought back in the 40s, which may have been a lot back then. But now, of course, land is so expensive. And again, the question, is this really a middle-class pursuit?
You know, that's an issue that I raised toward the end of my book and is probably the one that I'm most concerned with now. I'm moving on to some other projects, but in terms of my teaching, I raise this a lot. And in terms of talking about things like the locavore movement, there's also a connection here. Who has the leisure and the financial ability to make certain kinds of choices and who doesn't? There are plenty of homesteaders who I would call them middle class, some upper middle class, people who came to Vermont with money, and plenty of others who didn't. So I think it's important not to generalize. But I think raising this critique of, hey, you actually have the leisure to ask these questions in the first place about how to live a meaningful life and then make these kinds of choices, those aren't choices everyone can make. Mm-hmm. And in connection with locavore, I think that's important too, because that's not necessarily an affordable way to live for everybody. And I think those questions are now being raised, which is great. So we have to talk about class and race and things in these connections, which is what I try and do in my teaching quite a lot.
Let's move next to Jericho and talk with Tucker. Hi, Tucker. Welcome to the program. You with us, Tucker? All right. Let's try Mark in Rochester, New York then. Mark, are you there?
Yes. Good afternoon.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I've been a big fan of Helen Scott Nearing's for quite a few years, and I was introduced to them by local people here in Rochester who in this day and age have a bean sprout business and is doing very well here in Rochester, New York. But I've always been a big fan of homesteading, and looking at it due to the economy here, possibly going back to the old ways of homesteading could help our economy a little bit more in this day and age. And I was wondering her view on that technique.
Mark, I would first ask you if you could elaborate a little bit, because I'm not sure. Certainly, Scott was making an economic argument, as are a lot of other people when they homestead, in terms of at least partial self-sufficiency. But I wasn't quite sure where your question was going, so if you could say a little bit more.
My question is, because if we could look at the old custom ways of homesteading, can that help our economy today? Because I think we are getting away from old ways of farming, and it might help our economy if we were to look back at the older ways lifestyle.
Well, I think it'll certainly help people's individual home economies, which is what homesteading was about. I mean, there's the criticism, and I'm speaking out of the range of my field, but the criticism has been raised over time from the 19th century forward of, oh, if you're doing this all yourself, will the economy crumble because we're not buying the kinds of things we should?
You're not being good consumers.
Right, exactly. So, in fact, in many cases, I don't buy this, but in many cases, the critique of homesteading has been that we're going to, people who are homesteading are going to get in the way of sort of a thriving economy. That's not what Thoreau believed or Scott Nearing believed. I think the point to make that I would emphasize, it gets back to what you were saying earlier, Steve, about growing big gardens, which almost everybody in Vermont who I know does something like that, is, what do you gain practically, materially, also spiritually, psychologically? The range of gains you get from growing your own food or being part of a CSA and knowing the farmers who grow your food, that sort of local economy, whether it's whatever its relationship is with the national economy, I think that kind of local economics is very important. It's important also in terms of carbon footprint and climate change. So there are many economies. Wendell Berry wrote a great essay called Two Economies where he gets at this. So I think it's a really interesting question mark that you raised, and I think there are a lot of different ways to answer it.
Has technology changed how we approach homesteading? And I'm thinking specifically in the ways in which we can generate our own energy that we didn't have access to 50, 60 years ago.
Yeah, what's really interesting there, and again, I want to say that Donna Brown's great book on Back to the Land Movements, I think, touches at this toward the end, is that these practices that were seen to be very countercultural and very strange in the 70s, talking about solar hot water, are now things that are quite common. I mean, they're still not the mainstream, but technology has changed to make homesteading or just living in Vermont easier. People can make choices, even if they never call themselves homesteaders, to produce their own energy. And so that conversation, you could say, was originally very countercultural and now is becoming increasingly mainstream.
Here's a comment from Phil in Burlington who writes, while some went back to the land, some others have done urban pioneering, moving into areas of cities that have been neglected. And Phil asks, do these movements necessarily have to be rural?
Not at all. And one of the things we were talking about earlier that I want to bring up is, I think it was about a decade ago now that the New Yorker had a great article about how sustainable, how green is Manhattan, given sort of the low carbon footprint when you think about everybody walking and living in small spaces. And there's a lot in urban renewal literature that's talking about the greening of cities, which I am completely behind. That's not a scholarly analysis. That's just my opinion. I think it's a great approach.
And I guess that gets to the idea, you know, is homesteading for everyone, or if everyone decided to adopt it, would we have some problems?
Exactly.
Then?
No, I mean, if everybody bought 5 acres and a living, 10 acres and a living, that's the name of some of these homesteading books over the years, that's perhaps not the best use of our resources. So, again, to reemphasize, my interest originally has been, you know, how are people solving problems of meaning for themselves? As I'm not advocating one thing or another, I think we have to raise deep questions about how to lead both the meaningful lives and ecologically responsible lives.
And this is one approach, but there are others.
Right.
Let's talk with Tim in Williston. Tim, thanks for calling.
Hi.
Hi.
So I just thought I'd make some comments. We were on one of those 5-acre properties in Williston. When we moved here, it was one of the 70s suburban sprawls where, you know, some land got broken up into 5- and 10-acre lots. And we operate a homestead here that we call Honeydew Homestead. We use about half of it for growing food. And we have, we raise maybe about 150 meat birds that we sell some and we keep some. And we have layers and honeybees and fruits. And I guess my comment I wanted to make is, you know, it's not just something that we jumped into immediately. We've been doing this for maybe 10 years and, you know, start small and then next year, you know, we looked at what we thought we could add and sort of grow and expand to fit our lifestyle. But, you know, you've been commenting on how to define homesteading. And my wife and I, we define it as not, we differentiate it from farming, where we're not growing or raising things for an income. But as Rebecca was saying, to put food on our table, probably about 60-65%, and then sell enough to people who can't do it to help offset our expenses so it reduces our cost to do what we're doing. So that's kind of how we define homesteading. It's a way of life. My wife was part of the, when she was young, the Back to the Land movement in California. But I was raised in the middle of the old North End in Burlington and, you know, was totally oblivious to it. And I think as we partnered up, this became our way of life, especially after our two boys left home and we became empty nesters. So now we just have different nests.
Tim, thanks so much for the comment. Let me follow up, Rebecca, before you respond with a similar comment and a different point from a homesteader in Chelsea who writes, I raise my own pigs, sheep, chicken, beef, and dairy cows, as well as vegetables. I take exception to the use of the word simple to describe this kind of life. I understand the intention of its use, but I think it gives a false vision of this life to those otherwise unfamiliar with it. Growing your own food is incredibly difficult, laborious, challenging, and exhilarating, but it's not simple.
Well, I don't think it's simple. I think that the Nearings were trying to pretend that it was at
times. I used the word simple.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Oh, okay. So actually, I teach a whole course at Middlebury College, have taught, hope to teach again, called Simplicity in American Culture, and the thesis of the course is that simplicity, quote unquote, is very complex and difficult. So I'm glad you made that point. It is a lot of hard work. And Tim, it sounds like you've got a great project going on there in Williston.
Let's move next to Rob, who's calling us from Hebron, New York. Rob, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. I feel it's almost impossible to talk about this subject without mentioning the fact of the influx of hippies that came along. Well before the homesteaders, they were past this. They rejected the status quo in American lifestyle, and as a result, they got into gardening and that sort of thing. Anyhow, I think Vermont owes a lot to the hippie movement. I grew up in Vermont in the 60s and participated and witnessed all this.
Thanks, Rob. I think a lot of people tie the two together, really, because a lot of hippies who came to Vermont were living communally, let's say, trying to farm and do various homesteading activities.
Yeah, there's a clear overlap, and that's something I talk about. But obviously the homesteading impulse goes way back to mid-19th century.
Yeah. Here's Ann in Heartland for Rebecca Neal Gould. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say I came to this lifestyle kind of through a back door. I had chemical sensitivities, so which I figured out. Once I figured out what was going on within the space of about 6 months, I entirely lost my income, which was a website developer, and I had to spend all my time outside because of chemical sensitivities. I had to move to Vermont because the air here is decent. And I also had to stop buying stuff because everything that had petroleum in it, which is just about everything, as I discovered when they gave me a rash, has petroleum in it. So from the outside, it looks like a really austere life, but until you've lived it, I really haven't experienced such joy since I was a child as this life that was thrust upon me.
That's great to hear, and I think that's a real underlying theme in all of this, is how do you make a life of joy? How do you make a meaningful life? And what led you there may have been a bad experience like yours or good experiences. But in either way, these choices that I've been thinking about and writing about are really about how to make a life of meaning.
Thank you, Ann, for the call. Rebecca, you're working on a book, I understand now, called Spacious.
That's
concept
right.
Being spaciousness.
Yeah, I used to say it was a book about time, and I realized that was too shallow a term for what I'm talking about, and it connects, again, with this question about how to live a meaningful life. But it's not an academic book so much as it's me really exploring that topic from both a personal and a scholarly approach, and really walking with Thoreau in that process, looking at why he needed space and time to do what he was doing, and talking about how our contemporary culture is a culture of haste, hurry, waste, and how can we live differently in the context of that culture without throwing it over or going back to land, but just in our daily lives, creating spaciousness.
Great. Well, good luck with the book.
Thank you.
Rebecca Neal Gould, thanks for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Steve. It's been great.
In a moment, we'll find out about the many downtown Wi-Fi zones that have been cropping up all over Vermont. This is Vermont Edition. And welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Steve Zinden for Jane Lindholm. For those of us who can't bear to be without internet access, things are getting a little bit easier in Vermont. By the end of this week, Windsor will launch a Wi-Fi zone for its downtown. That'll make it the 26th and final town to benefit from the Vermont Digital Economy Project. It didn't come about without a few technical challenges, and here to tell us about these Wi-Fi zones is Caitlin Lovegrove, the Network and Outreach Coordinator for the Vermont Digital Economy Project. Caitlin joins us now to talk about how these networks were set up and who's using them. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So 26 towns, how were those 26 chosen, Caitlin?
Well, our money for the grant came from a federal disaster relief grant. So originally we had an application process and focused primarily on towns that were impacted by the flooding in 2011 from Irene and the spring floods. So we did some targeted outreach to those towns to see if they felt that a Wi-Fi zone or a Wi-Fi hotspot would be helpful. And once we heard back from those, we started there. And as the word spread, we got more applications.
And as those towns gave you feedback when you sent out those initial inquiries, what reasons were they giving for needing Wi-Fi zones?
I think on a very, very basic level, the idea of having a downtown that's lit up by Wi-Fi sparks that sense of cool. Which is what a lot of downtown revitalizations are looking for. They're looking for something to signal to people coming through and people who live there that they have the idea of being forward-thinking. And having free Wi-Fi in their downtown certainly shows that.
Does it vary from town to town, or is it basically pretty much the same in every town? You drive into town and there's free Wi-Fi, or towns using it in different ways?
It varies a little bit. We have some larger zones. So, for instance, Waterbury and Bennington, that the main street where all the businesses are both covered in Barrie as well. But we also have some smaller hotspots. So, you know, you get to a town such as Waterville, and they really have limits in terms of cell coverage up there and in terms of connectivity in general. So having their town hall have Wi-Fi allows for people to go there and be able to connect just at all.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I imagine there are people who are living in some of these downtown areas. For them, does it essentially represent free broadband?
We try to make that differentiation pretty clear. The idea behind having a free Wi-Fi zone is really for visitors and for people who maybe can't, for any number of reasons, have access at their homes to come in and use the internet. But we definitely don't want it to be a replacement for your home internet connection. We put some restrictions on to make sure that, you know, people aren't, say, streaming Netflix 24 hours a day on our system.
Mm-hmm. And are businesses embracing this? Do they see it as an economic development or a way to boost the local economy?
Absolutely. That's sort of one of the main draws of putting these in, besides being the signal and giving access to people who might otherwise not have access within the community, is to really involve the businesses and the business community. When we set it up, we have it so that when you log on to the network, you get redirected to a page that thanks all of the businesses who have contributed to the network and also lists all the businesses in town. The idea being that if you're driving through, you see a sign that says free Wi-Fi, so you decide to check your maps or your email, you suddenly land on a page and you realize that there's five different places to eat lunch that you might not have noticed just driving through. And then you see there's a beautiful bed and breakfast. Maybe you spend the night. So it's definitely helpful for businesses.
The first of these Wi-Fi zones went up sometime last year, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yep. We had our first launch last summer in Royalton and followed shortly by Bethel.
Any quantitative information at this point as to how much these zones are being used?
Sure. Let's see. Bethel's still one of our biggest ones. So over the past week in Bethel, they've used 31 gigabytes of data. We've had 206 unique users in just the last week in Bethel. And it depends a little bit, again, depending on how big they are. But the main use across the board seems to be Facebook. People just, you know, getting in touch with their friends while they're in town.
Are these people who live locally generally, or is there any way to tell, or people who are passing through?
A little bit of both. You can tell if someone's a repeat user, so you can see how often they're on. And there are people who use it, you know, almost every day. And we definitely get people who come in, you know, once or twice and use it when they're in town and then never again, which means they were probably visitors passing through.
Yeah, I just wonder whether there are some people in these communities who live in the outlying area and don't have broadband access. Perhaps they're the ones coming in to use the Wi-Fi systems.
Sure. And, you know, one of the things we heard when we launched one of those first networks in Bethel is that before we had the Wi-Fi, there was one place in town that had its own little Wi-Fi and people used to park outside of it and get online there. And now because the entire town has that access, you know, they have more options of where to park and don't necessarily have to clog up in front of that one business.
And who maintains the system once you've got it up and running?
We have a system where we really give it over to the community, and whether it's someone within the town structure or someone within a business partnership, we train moderators to look out for the zone. We make sure that someone is responsible for owning the equipment once we pull out. So it's really a community activity, a community-owned network.
You mentioned that they were funded through a disaster relief grant of some sort. How do you imagine that these towns that did experience damage in Tropical Storm Irene might, in the next similar storm, have an advantage by having these Wi-Fi areas?
Well, one of the things that we heard when we were talking to some of the initial applicants, and just as a caveat, our grant does a lot more than just the Wi-Fi zones. We also help small businesses and nonprofits and municipalities with websites. So all of these are working to improve the tools and the access that people have so that when another disaster hits, they'll be able to communicate with each other. And with the Wi-Fi zones, what we found is that people tended to gather after the storm hit in central locations, but they had no central place to get information from necessarily, even though a lot of municipalities were doing wonderful jobs of publishing daily papers or having daily meetings. With the Wi-Fi zones, because you're directed to a specific landing page, the idea is that if everyone is coming on and maybe they can't get cell service, but as long as there's enough power to power the zones, they can get online and be directed to a page that has the same information. So everyone is getting the same information.
You mentioned towns being able to set up their own websites as part of the grant, Caitlin.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And was this something that all 26 communities did?
There are 20 different communities who are setting up their own websites or updating websites. Yep. And not necessarily the same as the 26 who got Wi-Fi zones.
Right, and how is the grant helping them do that?
Well, so that's through the Snelling Center for Government, and it's, again, a very community-oriented process. They start by really walking through whatever web presence a town has already, looking at what it's being used for, and then they hold community meetings to see what the community wants to see on a municipal website. And based on all of that feedback, they structure the website to really allow for the easiest use by people who really want to use it.
And in terms of, you know, we've talked about 26 towns, obviously. There are a lot more towns. Are there resources available for other towns that might want Wi-Fi zones but don't have them?
We are, as our grant winds down, working to put together, you know, more information on how this particular system works in terms of really a community-oriented approach and involving a lot of different parties.
Is one of the advantages here, you mentioned in Bethel, for example, there was one business, I think it was the pizza place, actually.
Right.
That had Wi-Fi, and people were relying on that. They no longer have to do that. Does that sort of create a situation where then businesses really don't have to worry about providing Wi-Fi if they're located in these particular towns?
Well, the primary use of the Wi-Fi is outside, so it's sitting in park benches or along the main street as you walk down Main Street. As you get into the buildings, the signal can start to decrease a little bit, so a lot of businesses do have their own Wi-Fi as well, which also has fewer restrictions. So it's helpful for businesses to keep their own if they think it's helpful for their clients.
All right, Caitlin Lovegrove, thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Caitlin is the Network and Outreach Coordinator for the Vermont Digital Economy Project. We do have a list of the 26 towns that are now online with free downtown Wi-Fi services. You'll find all that at vpr.net. And it's time for another summer school lesson. Today we're going to learn a few important safety tips in kayaking. When you're out on the water, even in a calm lake or pond, your boat might flip over. And when that happens, it's natural to panic. There are a couple of options of what to do next. You can perform a wet exit, where you basically rip off the spray skirt that keeps the water out and slide out. Or you can do a roll, which allows the kayaker to get right side up without having to get out of the water. We went to the Waterbury Reservoir and got tips on both methods from Ben Schott, a kayak and paddleboard instructor for Umiak Outdoor Outfitters.
Usually people will try a wet exit, actually, on land, and it's a dry exit, just to go over how you would actually do it.
When I'm getting ready for a wet exit, first thing I'll do is I'll tuck forward and I'll pluck the skirt towards my body, and then I'll huck the boat over my body. When I'm free of my boat, I just relax. I wait for the water to let me go, and I'll come up to the surface, and once I've surfaced, then I'll bring my head up. I won't bring my head up from my tuck until I am all safe at the surface.
We first do that on dry land to demonstrate so people can understand what's going on, and then we'll demonstrate and have them do it in the water as well. So with the roll, the biggest thing is you want to make sure that people are doing the roll safely and efficiently. So the whole idea of the roll is so you don't have to wet exit, and so you can, if you flip over either to cool off or by accident, you can safely get back up without having to get out of your boat. Saves time, saves energy, and saves a lot of hassle. With the roll, it's the same idea as with the wet exit, where the first thing you want to do is you want to tuck. And the tuck will allow you to get your arms and your shoulder, you know, closer to the surface of the water. And there's a couple different rolls that people tend to learn. One is called the sweep roll. So you start with your paddle right next to the boat, so both blades are on the surface. And it's a twisting motion with your core, and you almost make a rainbow arc with your paddle blade as you're twisting your body. And you want to end up on the opposite side. The number one thing that happens when people are learning how to roll is they always try to bring their head up first. And that's the the last thing you want to bring up, because your head is a lot heavier than people think, especially if people have big egos. But if you wait for your head, your center of balance is going to be a lot lower, so it's a lot easier to get your body over your kayak and your kayak under you before you finally sit up straight, so to speak.
It's a lot of fun.
That was Ben Schott, an instructor for Umiak Outdoor Outfitters, helping us right the ship when our kayak overturns. VPR's Rick Singeri produced that story, and our summer school theme music is by Torpedo Rodeo. That's it for today. Tomorrow, Vermont's out-of-state prisoners. Nearly 500 men are being housed in privately run prisons outside of Vermont, and now there's an effort to bring those prisoners back. We'll discuss what it would take to do that and if the state's corrections department thinks it's a good idea. Send your questions or comments about Vermont's out-of-state prison population to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Neil Charnoff directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. Jane Lindholm will return tomorrow. I'm Steve Zinn. Thanks for listening.